If you're in Ephesians 6, you're probably mind is filling up with all of the topics that are dealt with in that. It's family, children, armor of God. And many of those have some obvious applications and some not so obvious. So Ephesians is a beautiful book. The first few chapters deal with our identity as Christians and who we are now that we have been saved, and who we are not, dealing with what we've been saved from and the change. And then it moves on into 4 and kind of see the first major instruction in chapter 4. It's to live our lives in a certain way according to what God is doing, which is bringing himself glory. I recently had an acquaintance ask me, why does all of these terrible, terrible things happen in the world, right? Or actually, the context was the Old Testament. So why were there so many massacres, so many genocides, so much death? Why did God allow that? And somebody I happened to be with, a pastor friend, answered for me because I had not formulated one yet. And I really liked his answer. It was for God's glory. Things happen. God allows things to happen in the Bible. In many ways, he orchestrates it for his glory. That's how we define whether it's okay or not. We are to live our lives in a specific way according to what God is doing. And that is one of the things that the Ephesians were struggling with, is still seeing them as their own people, right? This is my life. This is my energy. This is my money. I'm going to live it my way. Well, no. You were purchased and bought with something very valuable, right? The cleansing flood we just sang about. And you have a very specific job. It's to live in a way that will honor God. So it's how to walk in Ephesians 4 and 5. The second major instruction we can find in chapter 6, 10. It says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. So what is the command? It's to be strong. Okay, and that has a lot of implications in it. If you're a man, you're probably thinking along the lines of physical strength. If you're a woman, you might be thinking the same thing, or character strength, whatever it is. And nowadays, we have a military that's made up of both genders. And so whatever you're thinking of in terms of strength or strong, it's not physical, necessarily, although that makes an excellent metaphor, which is why Paul uses it in a moment. But verse 10 is saying to stand strong, and he gives a list of reasons. This isn't my outline yet, this is just the intro. In verse 12, why should we stand strong? Because we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world. God and us have an enemy. And the enemy of God is coming to undermine everything God intends to do with his second creation, right? What is his second creation? Well, the world was his first Genesis, right? And when we mucked that up, and then Adam handed sin down and down and down and down, a second Adam had to come to fix what the first Adam broke. And with that coming of Christ, it led to a second creation. Whenever he regenerates a soul, that is a new thing. We get new natures that are just as powerful as our old natures, if not more so, because we have the Spirit's help. But Satan is coming to undermine everything God intends. 13 continues with, wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand it in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. So the antidote to the actions of the enemy of God is proactively standing fast, not passive, but taking it persistently to the enemy by saying, I am here, or better yet, God is here with me, and I'm not going to move. There are some cultural things in the last 40, 50, 60 years that a lot of our Christian brothers and sisters have compromised on because it's too painful to not compromise. You think about, any really controversial issue, right? The fight against abortion, right? Prayer in schools, what political party you are, alcoholism and tobacco. I mean, you name almost anything, homosexuality. And somebody you know has compromised on it, right? It's not hard to think of examples. You and I are instructed that the enemy of God is going to attack every foundational base that we have, and if we don't persistently, intentionally stand against him with God, we are going to do the opposite of standing. Now, I'm not going to come have the teens come up here and do a trust fall, although I think I mentioned a couple months ago we were going to do that sometime. I don't like trust falls, mostly because I don't know a ton of strong young people that I trust not to be funny about it and drop me. But that's what happens to someone who doesn't stand. They fall. So we have a very specific instruction in verse 10 and why to do it. We're to be strong in the Lord. And this is not what I'm going to talk about tonight, but it is a very specific way in the strength of his might. Excuse me, power of his might. There is a lot of Christians out there, sometimes me included, who try to stand by themselves. And whenever that happens, however well-intentioned that Christian is, it always leads to falling. Why? Because you're relying on a human. And as mature and responsible as that human might be, they are human. We cannot do it our way. Which, I think, leads me into my first premise, which is we must use God's invincible armor and weapon to please him and battle Satan. Now, this goes all the way into verse 13, which I led you into a little while ago. The ability to stand relies upon the donning of the entire armor of God. I could break this metaphor down all day, but we don't have time for that. The point is that a warrior who goes into battle unprepared is not going to last very long. Some element of their equipment fails, they are susceptible to attack from that area or in that area. So how can we stand? What is this invincible armor and weapons? All right, this is lined out from 13 on. 10 on is just the context, but from 13 on are the six armor and weapons that a Christian is supposed to have about them to succeed in this second instruction, which is to be strong in the Lord. We're really only going to talk about one tonight, and that's the first that is mentioned, which is the truth. And I know in modern translations, it says belt of truth, and I'll get into why that's actually a bad translation. But KJV says, having your loins girt about with truth. The five armor pieces are imbued with God's strength. And that's not because they're magical, it's because they're characteristics, they're spiritual characteristics that if a Christian takes them seriously and acquires them over time, they will have a very real effect and usefulness to that Christian's walk through life, or that soldier, if we're going to stay with the metaphor. If we're not standing and Satan has the advantage, it's because we're not using the tools God laid out, okay? So if we're here and we don't end up standing, if we do end up falling temporarily for a length of time, whatever, then it's not because God didn't offer the equipment to the army. It's because the soldiers failed or refused to equip themselves of the ready things. You think about David going to fight Goliath, and in that case, he tried on the armor and what? refused? Well, for one, it wasn't made for him. And two, he had faith that Saul did not, right? This armor is made for us, custom made, if you want to get to it. God told us how to relate to spouses in chapter 5. He told us how to relate to family in chapter 6. And finally, he comes around to this concept of truth. And it really is the heart of the armor set, which is foundational to the rest, all right? The waist is not just at the center of our body. But truth, when you think about its definition and its character, has to be at the center of all of our lives. There are a number of verses I'm going to share in a moment from other parts of Scripture that talk about truth. The actual command about truth is in verse 14, and I kind of already read it. ESV says, fasten on the belt of truth. And like I mentioned, the word belt didn't actually exist in the original text. It says more or less exactly what KJV was, which is have your loins girt about with truth, right? Your loins or anywhere in this area, and to have them girt about is surrounded with them. Girt is a version of gird. Gird your loins, which is actually an action which messengers or runners would have to take, because at the time, the men serving wore tunics, and many of them, it's not very apparent. Oh, I had you take it down. It's not very apparent from James's breastplate, but those leather things, they would often hang down to the knee or well below the knee to protect the thighs in battle. And if you wanted to be quicker than not, you had to get rid of those literally slapping. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been slapped with leather, but it really hurts. Like, really, really hurts. If you want to be quick, you gird your loins, you tuck those into your belt, and then, boom, your legs are free to run, right? So the idea is that the person reading this is preparing themselves to do something important with truth. There's no belt involved, and you could argue, you know, yes, you either have it or you don't have it, especially nowadays. I mentioned that list of things under attack, right? Absolute truth is probably the top of that list. The idea that there can be multiple truths about the same thing that are contradictory is, you and I know, preposterous. However, that is the product being sold in our modern world, right? You can say it's white, I can say it's black, and we're both right. That's not how that works. Truth in and of itself, I'm going to get ahead of myself here a little bit, but its nature is singular. Why is it so important that we be prepared to gird our loins with truth? Satan's primary goal has been to question the veracity of God's words. If you think about the initial way that he decided to attack God's established creation and kingdom, it was to go to one of his creations and question whether or not God had said something. So from the outset, Satan attacks the accuracy and the adequacy of God's words. And he has not changed his playbook at all. Every time we are tempted to sin, it is because we are questioning what we know about what God has said about that thing. Do I believe what is in the Word about the topic we're talking about? And am I going to trust God that he knows best and do that thing? Every time, every sin can be tracked down to that question. Truth is an essential component of God's character and the fundamental essence of who he is and what he does. We're going to explore that a little bit about how to define truth. There was a senator in the 40s that said, "In war, truth is often the first casualty." And a war is a terrible human thing that does occur when many things go awry. And it's true. Usually truth is left far behind when mankind is led to war. What does the Bible say about truth? It's in Proverbs. It's in Psalms. Psalm 33 says, all his work is done in truth. Psalm 119 says, the entirety of your word is truth. John 14:6 says, I am the truth. That was Jesus. John 17 says, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. That, of course, is being God in the Bible. Sanctify them by God's truth. Your word, the Bible, is truth. And those are singular articles. If there's one place to live, in life to find truth, it should be with the people of God's church. If we're truly going to claim to worship the God of truth, who created truth and defines truth, then calling ourselves people of God means that people need to be able to come here amongst us and find the truth about life, yes? If we can't be messengers of that in a specific, accurate way on a constant basis, then we don't really deserve to call ourselves people of God, ever. God does not want lukewarm warriors. We as a church ought to be holding up for the world or showing the world the truth of Scripture for the entire populace to see. This is where we get to my outline, the importance of truth. Okay, standing for it is not optional. I didn't mention this earlier, but this one verse, 13 and 14, in about 20 different words there, we're instructed to stand three different times. Why do we stand? For God's glory. How do we stand? In the power of his might. How are we going to stand when we have the wiles of the devil after us? Don the armor of God. Standing up will happen in your life unless you choose not to put on the armor. And the armor starts with truth. It is central to assisting you in your equipment wearing. Something unique about this armor in those days was a Roman soldier's belt did not only pull his outfit together and center his equipment, it also identified him. And there were no women in the Roman soldier army for many different reasons, but each unit had a different colored tassel set. They were probably made of leather. I know Scots a lot of times identify their clans by the shade of plaid or whatever they wore. This is very similar. And so if there were several units assigned to the same town and you needed to know quickly what soldiers were from which unit, you say, he's got a green, brown, and red dyed thong, and he's got a brown and I don't even know the colors available, purple and yellow, then that guy belongs to that camp and that guy's supposed to be way over there. Why are you over here? It identified. I can't imagine they fought a whole lot of people dressed like them, but in the middle of a battle, this would be a fast way to identify who belonged to who. And if you update that to nowadays, in the spiritual world, how do you know whether or not the person beside you is on the same side? They're not contradicting the nature of your officer's commands. If we worship and work for the God of truth, then Christians who deny absolute truth are pretenders and traitors. If they're not going to stand on the same word we stand on. Our public lives should be that we look like we have God's truth in the center of our life. Truth is important also because it binds all the armor together. I don't want to take this too far, but soldiers were known for having a ton of equipment. Now, a lot of people have argued Paul would not have been guarded by a man that was fully in full regalia, right? Who had his hat on and his pauldrons and his multiple swords. He was probably a less equipped soldier or a house guard, But the idea is still there. The belt is central to the importance of the soldier's armor. Many of the breastplates at the time hooked or tied to the belt so that when you did combat, you did not stretch too far and have your midriff in danger either. I mentioned that those things, the tassels that hung down from our breastplate, right? Those were leather. They often went past the belt too. So it was very much a similarly placed place. This was also where they hung their swords. Okay, can you imagine needing to have your weapon quickly and suddenly your scabbard is not where you put it last? Talk about panic. Hopefully you know when you're going into battle, but for us Christians, we have no idea when we're going to encounter the next unbeliever or atheist or believer that has gone awry. We have to be prepared constantly. And part of that is remembering that truth is important. But it's not just important, it's also sourced in something that is vital. Romans 11:36 says, "For of him and through him and to him are all things, and to him be glory forever." The source of truth is ultimately God. I talked about this a little bit when we talked about being a person of God or a people of God. But it is imperative that you and I be able to identify the truth correctly, because in life, we are going to be expected to do so with the situations that come down the pike. And it's hard. Okay, Luke, we're in a little while, we're going to have Luke lecturing about modern ethics. You tell me, I'll give you any scenario in ethics, and it is can be complicated. By definition, it is difficult to parse out what the right thing to do is nowadays because humans have complicated the world. And part of that is Satan. So what is the truth? It is whatever God has said and whatever he has done. If God is truly the Father of truth, and he is, and he defines the nature of truth, and he does, then whatever truth is what God has said and what he's done. That's really simple, right? Sometimes in my life, I haven't had many of these chances, but I come across somebody who truly does not know what they think about very much. There's not a lot of those people, right? We like to be opinionated. Westerners are known for their opinions and the absolute, stubbornness, but absolute confidence in those opinions, whether they're right or wrong, right? That's not a good thing to be known for as a country. But you come across like somebody that, and they say, genuinely, how do you know? Or how can you be so confident in your belief? That faith. And this definition of truth totally takes the pressure off humans. Totally. You know how I know what's true? I read the Bible, I pay attention to God's character in it, and when I read something he said, I say, there you go. He's made it really easy for us in that way. God doesn't expect us to define truth. That's a job that we're not equipped to handle ever. Thank goodness. God did it for us. But we have to remember to apply it. I didn't write these down. I probably should have. Truth is absolute because no one can change it. This is a list of four different things truth is. And they're alliterated, so you'll like it. Truth is absolute because no one can change it. Even if people want to change the truth that we recognize, they can't. Not only can they not dig into your minds and change your opinion, they cannot change the nature of truth. Why? Because it's based on God's character, and he does not change. And he won't. And we should be grateful for that. And not only is it absolute, it's accurate, because it's sourced in God. I never have to ask whether or not that was the right thing to do, whether it was, you know, healing the lame, or the blind, or feeding the hungry, or rescuing the Israelites, because God did it, which made it right. And sometimes that's hard to understand because, as I just shared earlier, sometimes I don't know why he did what he did. And I really don't like having to explain that. Not that I don't know. I'm okay with saying that. Some things we won't ever know. But one of them needs to be the truth is accurate because God is its source. Thirdly, truth is authoritative, whether I agree with it or not. This is personal and convicting. Sometimes I read things in Scripture that I don't like. Can you imagine that? Usually it's somebody else coming to me like, hey, by the way, did you remember this verse? I really don't like those ones. It's authoritative. It has authority over me as a soldier of a child of God, whether I like that authority or not. And you know the funny thing about commanding officers is they don't care if you agree with them at all. You signed up for this. Do it. Get over it. My brother-in-law is in the National Guard. He just finished his summer training. Casey doesn't leave for hers for a couple months now, but he just finished his 2.5 week, whatever, and he got what's called spurs, because he's actually, his unit is attached to a cavalry unit, which doesn't have horses anymore, by the way. It's a tank cavalry unit. I don't know what that's supposed to look like. And he went through this hell week thing to get his spurs. And he almost didn't make it. I'm very proud of him. I haven't seen him in a while, but he almost didn't make it, but his commanding officer was not willing to lower the bar for any spur owners, earners. Why is that? Because they don't care about your feelings. The good ones don't. You have your buddies for that. You know, keep going. There was a lot of mud involved, in case you're curious. Our commanding officer has authority over us, whether we're okay with that or not. Lastly, truth is applicable whether I do it or not. I don't have to admit truth can apply to my life for it to stay truth, okay? I could be self-deceived, and unfortunately, many of us Christians walking through our lives are self-deceived because we have our pet sins, right? Our habits that we've formed over the years, and nobody can touch them because it's none of their business. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that your personal life is your church family's business. That's why we have a statement of faith. That's why we have a covenant. And that's why we have church membership and church discipline. There's expectations, guys. We have to look like warriors and fight like an army, or you're out. And it is imperative that we realize our relationship with the truth is central to those. Lastly, the nature of truth, and this is my favorite. John 1:14 says, is partially what I used for this. People often ask, if God came to earth now, what would he look like? Not physically. Like, what would he do? How would he act? Because we don't know, right? Man, I would love to know how he would talk to my neighbor. I would love to know who he would vote for in November. I would love to know how he chose his career path, you know, carpenter in dad's shop, and then itinerant preacher just seems very 1700s, I don't know. But we often forget we do know what God would look like and act like if he came to earth. How? He did come to earth. I think we often forget Jesus Christ is God the Son. And if you want to know what Jesus would have done, like was so common in the 1990s, all you have to do is read the Gospels. And that's not what Jesus would have done. It is, what would our God do? He was there. He created the world. And we get to read how he interacted with people. I listed a couple of the miracles earlier. Truth was an action that governed Christ's life when he was here. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The Word. And I think it's awesome that's one of his titles and synonyms, because we just finished reading a verse in the Old Testament that says, your Word is truth. If Jesus is the Word and the Word is truth, Jesus is the truth. Which matches, because he is God And God is the Father of truth. Just because we can't understand the Trinity doesn't mean we can't understand that. Jesus relates to truth by obeying his Father and speaking to us God the Father's words. He said multiple times, you want to know, people asked him what God was like. Man, were they totally clueless, right? And you know what he said? You want to know God? Get to know me. Man, how presumptuous. Right? No wonder the career religious people hated him. Truth controlled every area of Jesus' life, and not in a way where he was bitter about it, but in a way where he lived it in such a pure way that all we can do is hope to be a millionth of what he was. Can you and I honestly say today, tonight, as we're sitting here in this church, that truth controls each area of our life? And I'm using the word truth a lot. I know that. But the actual nature of it, not just honesty, but good work ethic. Being honest in your job, your relationships, being who you say you are, not being a hypocrite. Can we really say that the truth defines or controls each part of our life? There's no one that you are pretending for. There's nothing that you have said that you've reneged on. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I stopped making promises to my kids a long time ago because of that. I like the word maybe now, right? Which if you use it too much can almost be a lie of it in and of itself. They hate when I say maybe. Why? That often becomes no, right? Every once in a while it becomes a yes, and I like it when it can become a yes, but I like maybe. Why? Because I am who I am. Who I say I am now is who I am in 6 hours. There's no change. You and I have to be careful that truth controls each part of our life, which means we examine every area of our life, whether it's in devotions or church or just soul-searching our life, and we examine each chunk and say, does that part of me, and holistically, come into the submission under the authority of God's word? I know he's said to treat church people like family. I know he's said to tithe. I know he's said to witness. I know he is said to go into the uttermost parts of the earth. I know he said be holy. I know he said don the armor. I know he said all of these other things. Do each area of my life submit to those commands? Can you imagine if this was a real army, human army, and we got a command from Central and we said, meh, I don't know if I can fit that in during halftime. I didn't ask if you could fit it in. I said, do it. I don't think we'd make very good soldiers. No offense to those who've actually been soldiers in this room. God orders as our commanding officer to honor our parents. He mentions so many things just in Ephesians. To see yourself as bought. To cherish our spouse. To submit ourselves to the ultimate husband, Christ. There's so many commands just in this short book to this church. Lastly, truth was an attribute that filled Christ's life. Jesus was faithful to who God was. Jesus was obedient to what God wanted. Not only did he reflect God the Father's character so well on earth, he also did what he desired. You remember when he was praying in the garden that the cup of death and torture would pass from him. He didn't want to do it, even though he loved us sacrificially and unending. He didn't want to die that human crushing death. And actually, honestly, the physical death was like nothing compared to what God had to pour out on him, his spirit. But in the end, he said, not my will, your will. And unfortunately for you and I, this is not a once-in-a-lifetime thing where we can just pray that prayer of, fine, I submit. This is a daily thing. Once you're a child of God, you're in His family forever. And if you ever see that as a burden or a drag, you need to seriously reevaluate your identity. You talk about people who have midlife crisis or identity crises. A Christian who does not want to be a Christian either doesn't understand what they've got or they're not. You and I need to be joyful, obedient soldiers of God like Jesus was. Do people see me as an authentic Christian because I look like the person I claim to follow? Who do I claim to be? Well, besides, you know, Baptist and Ben Hobbes and all that, I am a Christian. Do I look like a little Christ? Do I act like I am going to follow in my Father's footsteps, my spiritual Father, Heavenly Father? Do I look like that? If you were to evaluate each chunk of my life, do I look like that? Do you look like that? Should be the question on the edge of our minds. Is this the primary characteristic people think of when they think your name? Neighbor Bob, Brother Paul, Sister Sharon, Teacher Susie, whatever your relationship to them is. You say, you know what makes them unique? They always know what's right. They seem to have a relationship with the truth that is unforgiving in its passion, while not losing the love of Christ, it is unrelenting in its accuracy. Do people think that about you? I hope so. Psalm 51 says, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." Verse 6, "Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part you will make me to know wisdom." I already said that if we try this armor thing without God, we're going to fall flat on our face. God desires truth in us because, honestly, everything else gets sourced from inside. I can't show my sister love unless it's here already. I can't speak truth unless it's here already. And it has to be from God. It has to be His wisdom. I tried to do an application along the way, but I think I added some. Yeah. What are our marching orders? Submit to God's truth and His will. We can learn our orders by heart. Okay. A lot of times when missives were on scrolls or worse, you know, clay tablets in cuneiform or something, people would put them in memory, right? So you can always steal the message, burn the message, torture the messenger, but you can't get it out of their brain, right? You and I need to care so much about the Lord's orders that we commit them to memory. I'm not saying memorize the entire Bible, although that is a very worthy goal. Do you and I know enough about Him and His character and His desires to be able to do them? Are we a successful soldier in that way? Do we know His commands? And lastly, embrace the person of truth, which is Christ. And this is a double-edged sword in a way. Making Christ central to my life is something every Christian should do because we're trying to be Him. We're trying to be like Him. But it's also something that those who don't know Christ need to do as well. This morning, Dr. Anderson shared a story about a man that he prayed with that didn't know God. And he was pretending for a chunk of his life, a healthy chunk of his life. And while that hypocriticalism is sad, it is joyous when the Spirit convicts and somebody is actually honest with themselves and everyone else, right? People who need to embrace Christ are not just you and I, but those who don't know Christ. I don't think we have any visitors tonight, but there are a number of visitors through our church each month and each year. And each of those people, we don't know their spiritual state. No one can know the heart of man except God. It is imperative that they watch us live Christ, especially amongst each other, right? What are we to be known for? amongst ourselves, love for the brethren, right? Philippians. If they can't see the difference that Christ makes in us when relating to other people that we call family, I wouldn't want to be a Christian either. They're no different than that church down the street or across town or in the next county. You and I have to embrace Christ, embrace truth, to the point where it defines us. And that is a tall order, I know. And it's daily. It's one of those battles that you have to do daily, if not hourly, okay? You know, you can start a day excellently and then have a lousy afternoon and then a great evening. I mean, you've been there, right? It's almost minute by minute. Am I part of this army? Am I not? Am I going to submit? Am I not? Am I going to be courageous? Am I not? It's exhausting, which is one of the other reasons that we have to do it in the Spirit's power. He's the only one who can give us the endurance to get through this and succeed.